Hello and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that's very exhausted this week, much like an old 90-year-old man. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. Now, you may remember from last week, we were looking at a 4.5-hour movie of a filmmaker's artisanal, painterly exploration of dreams and meditations on life. Thankfully, this week, we're back with one that is also exactly the same, but only 2 hours. Dave, who are we, and what are we doing?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, throw it under the microscope, dissect it, spoil the living hell out of it, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, and all the usual shtick I say every week for anybody who's been around for the last little while. The important thing is that each and every week, the film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding episode. And Andrew, you were already hinting at it, but what were we taking a look at last time to kick off the year 2021?
We were looking at something that proved to be an interesting challenge, and on the whole, a rewarding one, I think, despite what it asks of its audience. We were looking at Wim Wenders' 1991 film, Until the End of the World, in its 4.5-hour cut. Now, that was a film that featured a very broad-scale production and a pretty broad cross-section of international actors. And we followed one to an area of film that we don't often get to. We decided to go to the land of the rising sun. That's right, we went to Japan following Shishu Ryu to a film that he appeared in a year prior. We are looking at legendary Japanese director Akira Kurosawa's 1990 film Dreams. I mean, Toshirô Mifune is not in this one, so I don't know if people are really going to pick up on the cast names. Other than Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, exactly. We followed the actor Shishu Ryu. Hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly. And look, I'm going to be straight up front here, folks. We're going to make every effort we can to pronounce these names correctly. That doesn't actually mean we're necessarily going to succeed at that, despite our attempts. So,
yes, we're going to do it to the best of our abilities, but please recognize those abilities are limited.
Yeah, and I would like to say, I believe this is the very first Japanese film we've looked on the show proper, not counting the crossover bonus episode I did with Ross May, looking at the Zatoichi franchise and all 26 original entries plus the 3 non-connected aftermath films that came out a couple weeks ago. It is still online and well worth seeking out, folks.
And that episode is still online and well worth listening to. Besides, you get to see how much more professional Dave is when I'm not there.
Questionable. But the point of the matter is, in this instance, yes, we are taking a look at, yes, the film Dreams from legendary director Akira Kurosawa, who is basically a filmmaker that, if you know your American film history, many filmmakers of the last, 50, 60 years basically worship at the altar of it. If you didn't have Akira Kurosawa, guess what? Star Wars wouldn't exist, folks. If you didn't have Akira Kurosawa, Steven Spielberg might not be quite the filmmaker he was today, to say the least, in this instance.
Here. I mean, I think, as I had in the notes, it's not exaggerating to say that if you took a random cross-section of people, asked, who knows Japanese cinema? Of the people who put their hands up, if you asked them to name a director, I think Kurosawa would absolutely be the first one. In terms of an international audience, I think it's safe to say that Kurosawa probably is the most famous native-born Japanese director of our time.
Well, yes, with maybe the closest one being his close collaborator and co-worker on this project, Ashiro Hondo, as well. But we'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, but only one got referenced by Bare Naked Ladies. But as we'll get into after the cut there, Kurosawa is an interesting figure because he's had a long career and he's made 30 films, which is 30 more than I have, but it seems like there ought to be more. But I think there's also very much this tendency to think that Kurosawa's work consisted of those more iconic and certainly more historical films like Rashomon, Hidden Fortress, Ran. But there's actually like a whole other facet to his filmmaking that I feel often doesn't get recognized and maybe is probably closer stylistically to what's going on in Dreams. But I mean, yeah, before we can really start at the beginning of a masterpiece filmmaker's storied life and storied career, We should probably begin by bringing us all up to speed on just what exactly is dreams and why doesn't anybody seem to remember that as fondly. And for that, we are going to turn to Dave, who, despite his exhaustion, is going to summon all that courage and give us the rundown.
Dreams is the 1990 anthology drama from legendary director Akira Kurosawa. Made up of 8 segments and inspired by Kurosawa's own Dreams, Dreams was released to strong critical notices, though it remains a lesser-known film in the director's filmography, coming up after film strips, an episode of the infamous Quatermass Down Under.
So I guess maybe as a point to start, as we often do, is our personal recollections. So Dave, considering that you have forgotten more movies than most people will ever actually see in their life, I'm going to guess that you probably knew who Kurosawa was from, let's say, teenage onward.
I had heard of Kurosawa, but I'm not gonna lie, I actually didn't get a chance to see his films until I was in university, mostly because in the era there was no access to Kurosawa's films. This is the pre-streaming years, folks. The DVD was just sort of budding onto the scene, and really the Amazon.ca was in its infancy, so you really couldn't order all that much from them yet.
Yeah, back in those days, there was, what was it? Netflix by mail, right?
That was going on, but I don't even think that was available in Canada until, like, what, the mid-2000s? Maybe I'm
Yeah,
wrong.
I used it once in Toronto. I forget what movie I even rented. Mailed it back. They said that I didn't, and then I changed my phone number,
See.
and then I moved.
See, this is why I never liked the whole, like, I get that this was the beginning where Netflix got its start, but honestly, I really never felt comfortable with any. It's like you send films in the mail and then you're trusting the postal service not to lose them. This seems a
Exactly.
dicey proposition at best.
Plus, if somebody steals that disc, it's actually two felonies at the same time. Yeah, it was a weird system, and I can definitely see why they no longer use that system. But yeah, university libraries in particular, though, they are the world's best video store. And the best part is, you don't have to be a full-time film major to take advantage of that.
That is absolutely true. So yeah, so basically borrowing films from the Laurier Wilfrid Laurier University Library was something I did often. Or if barring that, there was the late belated or beloved Gen X Video as well, where I often made ventures out to because it was maybe a 15-minute walk from my place to go in over and get it there. So
Well,
yeah.
Dave and I, we both actually went to the same university. I'm a couple years as younger, but I can also attest, growing up in a small town, reading about all these fantastic things, finally going off to university, and on top of that, you find a really kooky alt-oriented art video store. It was locally the stuff of legend. And even though it was pricier than the other places, it was cool. I mean, they even had shelves organizing films by directors, and I believe they had a special Kurosawa shelf.
They also have what appeared to be a bootleg copy of the Roger Corman produced Fantastic Four film, but that's a whole nother separate conversation as well. We'll leave that
Maybe that's why
aside.
they're out of business, David.
Possibly as well. Point of the matter is, but yes, Kurosawa had his own shelf. And I mean, there's kind of a reason for that. I mean, I think it's safe to say when we're talking about Kurosawa, we're talking about somebody who, on the international stage, is one of those filmmakers who, even amongst masters, is held as a master filmmaker in terms of his reputation, for the most
Yeah,
part.
and I mean, I feel like with Kurosawa, what people appreciate is not just the quality of its films in and of themselves, but he also has a background prior to filmmaking in being a painter. In this film, we clearly see that he has maintained a deep appreciation for fine art and painting, and there's, especially in his color films, there's very much a painterly element that comes across. And I think it that is as much an influencing factor on other filmmakers and sort of why they appreciate him. It's Kurosawa is not just a good filmmaker, but he's one who appreciates the value of his craft. He does not come off as an egotistical guy who's like, "Well, I'm gonna slap my name on this and it'll blow your mind." It's like maybe part of it is like exoticization in Western film scholarship, But there does seem to be something, I guess, organic that carries through a lot of his work.
Well, I think the other big thing, and I think what might sort of account for his reputation worldwide, is that there is, and I hate using this term because I don't like it, but there's a universality to his films that transcends basically maybe local cultural touchstones that might be more difficult for Western audiences to understand. Like the Ozu movies. Like, I mean, let's be clear here. Also a fantastic filmmaker, but they are much more built around having an understanding of what the social dimensions of Japanese culture is in a way that.
Yeah, and like especially being able to pick up on, oh, at this point there was actually a massive generational gap occurring in exchange in social values. Like Ozu doesn't spell that out to the audience. And I mean that's not to say Kurosawa spells things out, but if you also have a group of seven samurai who are hired for a mission, there's something more immediately readable in that.
Well, exactly. I mean, and there's a reason why a lot of his films were translated, or in other cases, just plain straight up ripped off by Western filmmakers or filmmakers from European countries. I mean, A Fistful of Dollars is a more. I'm not even sure if it's an official remake of Yojimbo or whether it was really just a case of Leone ripping him off. I'd have to go back and double check, but I mean.
Last Man Standing with Bruce Willis
Let's
is,
see.
I believe, a credited remake of Yojimbo.
Yes, it is.
Yo, Jimbo. But I think that also speaks to your point, David, of the sort of universality. It's that Kurosawa is a Japanese filmmaker who doesn't approach his films first and foremost as Japanese cinema, and certainly not like positioning itself as like an essential style or anything at the level of nation. It's just he's making films that are analogous to American Westerns. And I mean, the same plot crosses over very neatly, and you don't have to tweak all that much, right? But isn't it also true, though, that Kurosawa, that Yojimbo was itself inspired by Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest?
That I'm less positive about speaking about it. I mean, I certainly do understand that Kurosawa was himself a fan of international cinema and certainly borrowed elements from it. The degree of how that influence worked his way into his work, I would say you need a much more detailed film scholar familiar with his overall body to really make that claim with authority in a way that I cannot
Well, I
in this
can.
instance.
He
Yep.
has adapted a number of different works at different times, and
True.
not just from Japanese writers. So, for instance, Redbeard is an adaptation of Dostoevsky. He has a film adaptation of Dostoevsky's The Idiot that apparently also has a lost 4-hour cut of it. I have not seen that. But he also has The Dead Sleep Well, which is on Criterion. And that one is actually like a fairly close adaptation of Hamlet set in corporate Japan.
And let's not forget Ron, his film, which itself is basically, if I'm not mistaken, an adaptation of King Lear. So, I mean, he is not
Yes.
afraid to borrow from other sources as well. I'm just mostly thinking in terms of specific cinematic style or techniques or anything he's borrowing from. That I'm less certain about speaking with authority to. But you're absolutely right. He certainly is influenced there. And that's not to say that he, minimizes the cultural aspects of Japan in his work. It's just that because of the sort of universality of his plots or the sort of very straightforward recognizing, here are the sort of power play dynamics that are at heart in his work. It's much easier to not necessarily feel like you're going to get lost if you don't happen to know certain specific cultural touchstones in Japan while watching his most of his work.
But you're right about Kurosawa, and I mean, like, it's there are many Japanese filmmakers. Ozu is one of them. Kiyoshi Kurosawa is another. Sion Sono, who do very interesting work, but haven't been necessarily picked up at the festival level and sort of amongst other scholars to the way that Kurosawa has. But I think what's also very interesting, not to keep hammering universality, is the fact that like his films sort of appeal to people like George Lucas, in for their gee whiz wow adventure dynamics. But, I mean, as we see in this film, he also appeals to more quote-unquote serious filmmakers like Scorsese or peak era Spielberg as well. So it seems like, it's a bit reductive, but a big selling point of Kurosawa is that it seems everyone can take away something that they really value from his work. And you can't do that by just making the same film over and over or hitting the same themes. And so I mean, you can't take the tent poles even as necessarily indicative of a style. Like, there's very much a mood in Kurosawa, I guess.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And I mean, certainly this is kind of a big key for understanding of portions of Kurosawa's career as well, because my understanding is that starting at about the 1960s, while he'd been popular in Japan for some time, the popularity of a cinema at the local level sort of waned a bit at that time. And while there were sort of efforts to quote unquote bring him over to America, Tora 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 probably is most infamous because that was a film where he was gonna write and
Oh,
direct,
right, that movie.
He was going to write and direct sequences from the Japanese perspective of World War II. And he did, apparently, from what I understand, shoot that material. And then it was all gutted and cut from the film and rejected by the American studio bosses at the time. Which, yeah, it seems like a huge, massive mistake from my perspective, but we'll put that a pin in that for now. But the certainly the.
Well, I mean, they're like, well, we just have to write off the plane ticket and all the footage. Trust me, Kurosawa, you don't know the first thing about working in Hollywood. But yeah, so I mean, just looking it over, there's I'm not gonna pretend that I've seen every Kurosawa film, and I'm not gonna pretend that most people have seen certainly his earlier films. 'Cause his career begins earlier than you would think. He starts working in the film industry in 1936, so prior to World War II. And he gets his first job as a set painter. 7 years later, in 43, he makes the film Sanshiro Sugata, which I guess means Judo Saga. He makes five films in the next 4 years. None of them are huge. But then in 1948, he makes Drunken Angel with his good friend Toshiro. And then in 1950, though, that's the big international coming out point, I think, because that's when Rashomon gets made. And I mean, you and I, we both went to the same film curriculum. We probably understand Rashomon in similar ways, but that kind of is internationally successful, and most importantly, like, successful on the festival circuit, or what they had the equivalent of at the time. And that seems to be that's when Kurosawa becomes a name outside of Japan.
Well, absolutely. And certainly many of his films that would follow, such as Hidden Fortress, Seven Samurai in particular, and that doing these sort of big scale, what would be considered epics by comparison to most of Japanese cinema at the time, really make him a defining force. And again, they are making their way over into North America and are finding success on what effectively amounts to the art house circuit at the time there, even though ostensibly his films in many instances are populist entertainment in Japan itself. So, but again, I mean, that's the big thing. And then the 1960s
Yeah,
happened.
it's sort of like Crouching Tiger, how, I mean, we've often joked about Gene Shalit calling it one of the very best movies ever made. But I remember there was a lot of discourse around the differing critical reception in America versus in China, and the idea of, like, do Western film scholars, do we necessarily, like, elevate things just because they are different, right?
Well, absolutely. And that's, and again, that's not meant as a knock on Kurosawa, because as we'll get into, his filmmaking is fantastic, but it is the sort of bias that it's hard to sort of get around and think about when you're sort of, locked into a particular
And to
spectrum.
qualify, I mean, neither of us are at all interested in arguing whether or not Kurosawa is an authentically Japanese filmmaker or anything like that. Like, we've also talked before about how it's sort of pointless to try and define, like, a national aesthetic anyway. But yeah, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Just getting that out of the way.
Well, no, it absolutely makes sense. And so when you get into the 1960s, he's still making sort of big, huge films. And again, if you go back to that Zatoichi crossover episode with Ross May, we do talk about sort of the big two that were also highly influential, Yojimbo and its sequel, Sanjuro, there, which he does with Toshirô Mifune. And then a few things happen. There's a bit of a falling out with Mifune, which again, we talk about on that crossover episode there, where, because after a certain point, Kurosawa and him never make a film together again. I believe he has several box office duds. There's the Tora incident. And for a while there, he's not able to actually get a film made, as I understand it. And eventually by, I want to say it's the late 1970s, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg end up with a significant amount of power. Now, why are we suddenly jumping to those two? Well, as noted, they were huge Kurosawa fans, and amongst the things they did once they had significant power in that industry, because let's not forget, Lucas at this point had made Star Wars, you know, kind of that little movie that you may have heard of. Steven Spielberg had Jaws.
And that movie that, like, one of my favorite things to do is just play scenes from The Hidden Fortress to big Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
Because it's not subtle.
No.
Right? And I mean, that's not to say George Lucas ripped off Kurosawa.
He's paying homage.
Lucas is the sort of person who's very upfront about his influences.
Yeah.
And he believes very strongly in paying homage.
Yeah.
And I think if you were to ask him about any of these shots, he would happily tell you, oh yes, this was very much me trying to do what Kurosawa was trying to do here.
Well,
the problem is that in film credits, Star Wars does not get an inspired by Akira Kurosawa credit, right?
Well, no, and I mean, it's one of those cases where, I mean, Star Wars, I would say that that's fair in the sense that, yeah, Lucas is using a lot of elements, but he is definitely filtering it through a very different sort of lens when he's making that film. So
yeah.
I'll forgive it in that instance. But the important thing is that he certainly didn't fail to pay respect back, because him and Spielberg used their clout to effectively get financing for Kurosawa to make another film, which I believe was his 1980 film. I'm Kashimura. If I'm hopefully not mispronouncing the name on that one.
Let me look it up.
Yes. Things I should have quickly written down right beforehand.
Well, I could have written them down too. Let's see.
But the big point is that this helps put Kurosawa back on the map in a fairly significant...
Kagamusha.
That's the one. Yes.
Yeah, because what we see is, like, he has a fairly prolific career as well. Basically right up until 1965 and Red Beard. And, that is a period where he goes from making a film every year or two to suddenly 5-year gaps.
Yeah, and
and that checks out with difficulty in financing, but also 5 years, if you're trying to make epic films more on the regular, then it becomes more difficult. And really, up until the years, the very final years, Kurosawa sticks to that 5-year pattern. Because Kagamusha, 1980... 1985 is Ran, which is, I think we can agree, sort of like the high watermark cresting of the wave.
Yep.
And certainly in like the way that Kurosawa is often narrativized, right?
Yeah.
And then 5 years after that, we get Dreams.
Well, absolutely. And by all accounts, though, he had expected Ron was going to be his final film. Again, it's a loose adaptation of King Lear, and again, very much takes that story and places it in, I do not quote me if I may be mispronouncing, I think it's feudal Japan. I may be completely incorrect on that, folks, so don't quote me on my history. I'm sure Ross...
Sounds right to me.
I'm sure Ross will jump in and correct me on that one, if that's the case. So please, people, pay attention.
Idiot. It was actually the Edo period.
Just make sure you pay attention to @RossMay on Twitter. Trust me, it'll pay off in the long run. Point of the matter here is that, yes, when it comes to this, that one is a really huge critical success. I believe it was a box office success as well in Japan, and I want to say probably on the art house circuit as well. When it's released in 1985, but by all accounts, everyone, including Kurosawa,
actually, it makes about 20 million off a budget of 11. But I mean, I guess in the context of it's not aiming to be a blockbuster,
no,
the way that something like Star Wars or Jaws is, right?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, certainly, yeah. I mean, it's definitely more meditative than even Kurosawa's earlier epic Seven Samurai, which Again, that one is very much built as a crowd pleaser when you take a look at that film. Ron, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous, but it is a more demanding film in some ways of its audience. But by that point, I mean, you know,
And
he's
I mean, it's
been.
3 hours long. It is absolutely like you almost get the sense that he went through and like meticulously arranged every detail of the mise en scène. And I mean, it's worth it, but yeah, it is a film that is designed to be an epic film.
Well, exactly. So, okay, everybody thinks this is going to be his last film. He thinks it's going to be his last film. So you might assume, well, it's going to be his last film. Until a couple years later, and at some point during that time, Kurosawa basically start is inspired to, you know, for the first time in a good long while, write a film by his own, apparently inspired by his dreams, as the case was. And this is a film which it's you could call it technically an anthology movie, but I don't think that's really fits with what we get. The word I see a lot of people using around it is vignettes, which probably is about the most appropriate thing because these aren't
Yeah,
necessarily.
because it's not quite episodic, and there's not a necessarily clear narrative through line, but there's not even necessarily always the strongest thematic through line either. But there are enough overlaps and sort of common elements, certainly in how you can read this film, that it's not scattershot, you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. And the thing is, he writes the script. It's very personal. And again, it's something inspired by his dreams. He has Ashiro Honda, his good friend and longtime collaborator, who's working with him as a consultant of some sort. More on that later, as we get into the film proper. And he sets about trying to secure financing for this film, which he promptly can't do. Now, this is, as we've already established, Kurosawa's had some problems getting the money together over the last so 20 or so years of his career by this point. So this isn't necessarily a big surprise. He himself
Well,
apparently.
he's also 80 years old, and I mean, there's a certain amount of risk that comes with that, right?
Well, exactly. That's exactly why I don't believe Richard Donner when he says Lethal Weapon 5's coming. Because yeah, we're gonna put a 90-year-old director in charge of a big action movie during COVID times with the one of the most unmarketable leading men in all of Hollywood right now. You do you,
Well, when
Donner.
you put it that way.
But in this case, Kurosawa, he puts it the blame at the fact that he is making a film with some distinctly anti-nuclear themes. Now, one thing that, again, with the caveat that I may be misunderstanding my history of Japan here, is that by this point, nuclear energy had become sort of a very key component of Japanese culture and throughout the preceding decades, despite the rather, let's put it this way, touchy history about Nagasaki and Hiroshima at
Yeah.
this point. But again, it had almost.
There is a very different sort of symbolic emphasis that nuclear energy possesses in Japan than in America. Even over the same event, that pressure is felt very differently. I mean, America's nuclear conscience because of 3 Mile Island and what they did to others. But I mean, like that anxiety, it comes with real world technological change. And I mean, that's a negotiation, even going back to the Godzilla franchise. I think what often gets lost in sort of spoofing it and like the memory of it being like silly B movies is these are films that are very anxious about radiation.
Well, exactly. But it seems that, and again, with the caveat that I may be misunderstanding it, is that basically, in terms of political policy in the culture at large at that point, because there had been a big push to get into nuclear power stations, the government line effectively was that nuclear energy is safe, it is fine. And Kurosawa, who again lived through Nagasaki and Hiroshima in terms of being around when that happened, understandably doesn't have necessarily the same views on that. So his understanding, or at least his perspective on it, is basically that's where the line is coming in to sort of stop him from getting us. So you might think he's screwed at that point, right? Well, not exactly, because Andrew, who happens to be somebody he has on his Rolodex at that time?
Well, wait, which one? Lucas, Scorsese, or Spielberg?
Well, in this instance, we're talking Steven Spielberg, who at this point in time, yes, is again at the height of his powers, because let's remember, this is Spielberg after the 1980s. He's has another Indiana Jones film coming up, and he's a few years away from getting started on a little movie known as Jurassic Park. Point of the matter is, Spielberg's got probably the most clout he's ever had in his career at this point in time, and Kurosawa effectively calls him up and says, I'm trying to get financing. Is there any way you could help me secure it through US studios? And my understanding is that basically through Amblin Entertainment, Spielberg put his powers at work towards getting Warner Brothers to basically finance Dreams for Akira Kurosawa and succeeded in doing so. Hence why he has an executive producer title on this movie. Beyond that, I don't think he had any creative development or involvement in the film whatsoever. So
Yeah, it does not seem like the kind of film where Spielberg, I feel like he's the kind of person that would also just not deem it appropriate if he was telling Kurosawa what to do with this film. Like, everything about its production background speaks as a personal film by a masterpiece director, and sort of the whole reason of making it is that this is Kurosawa's like sort of ode to filmmaking. It's sort of his thoughts on life and his own philosophy as expressed through his dreams. I feel like if you're helping put up the money to do that, you're not then gonna turn around and be like, you need to add a chase sequence here, Akira.
Well, exactly. So, but yeah, with that, Kurosawa has his finances. He goes about assembling his cast. The big sort of the only real problem that I can see that happens during the production is that apparently there were originally supposed to be 11 short vignettes that make this film up, and eventually it was whittled down to 8 due to a combination of a shortened shooting schedule and financing probably not being in place to shoot every single thing that Kurosawa said. But if you can
I
get
mean,
eight,
it's
you know.
difficult to say if that would necessarily add anything to the film, because I think, as we'll very soon get into, the vignettes themselves, I think, are very much case by case, because again, there isn't always that consistent theme tying them together, so some of them feel much more self-contained than others.
Well, yes, in some ways. I think thematically, I'm going to argue that it's maybe a little more tighter and there's maybe a few more through lines than you see there. But we'll get into that. And that's probably the point we should get into here. Just to wrap up sort of the general
Oh yeah.
overview of the film itself.
Because I think the broader pattern you can sort of see is like it's 8 vignettes based on Kurosawa's dreams, but they also mark sort of a trajectory from childhood to middle age slash end of life. And
Exactly.
when a very outspokenly philosophical filmmaker is pulling it together for that one last shot at 80 years old to make a very personal film, you can sort of see why these themes are on his mind. I mean, you don't want to say that this film only has value in terms of like what we can read about Kurosawa in it, but it's also pretty clear sort of why it is the way it is.
Well, it's also a film that invites the viewer to read it in biographical terms to Kurosawa. And again, in ways that even I wasn't really anticipating, because as it turns out, you see this character wandering around in a very particular type of hat and shirt during the latter half of the film. And it is influenced apparently by what Kurosawa tended to wear on his film sets. It was usually photographed wearing
Well, the
that.
hat,
Yeah.
yeah.
And that's the thing where, again, I have to admit full straight up, I've never actually paid a lot of attention to the photographs of Kurosawa on set himself. So that's not something I necessarily would have picked up on. Instead, you would have seen me make like a terrible, oh, it's Hunter S. Thompson wandering through Japan. And that would have been the worst possible reading of all types
My
there.
God, Dave, that even I wouldn't have thought of going that way. But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, he's also, though, sort of muddying the waters is that some of the sequences are also a lot more abstract than others. And I mean, the sort of Kurosawa stand-in that we're supposed to take it as, Who is it? Akita Turao?
Yeah, there's several ones playing because there's a character
Yeah,
that recurs.
but
Yeah.
because the film begins sort of with the child, it's not immediately clear that we're presumably seeing the same character.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. And I don't even know if it ever really makes it clear in ways that make sense. Because again, and the film gains the leeway sort of as it's set up. So I guess this sort of brings us into the structure of the film proper here, because this is not, when we
It's
say that.
basically a subtitle announcing a dream and the title of the sequence, and then we see the sequence.
Well, and exactly, and the thing about it is that what we keep calling the film Dreams, but I think if there was ever a case where the director's name, in that sort of possessive way that we tend to associate, like John Carpenter's The Thing, if this was ever a
Ah,
case where
yes.
you the words, the director's name preceding the title really kind of fits, I have a hard time not calling it Akira Kurosawa's Dreams, because this film is very explicitly, as it's set up, the idea that we are seeing somebody's dreams. And as each of these things open up, we see the phrase at the start there. The first one is, I had a dream, dot, dot, dot. And then we go into the dream, and this repeats every time. I had another dream. I had another dream. I had another dream. And that's all the real framework we get in terms of.
Yeah, like this is not this isn't like Tales from the
No.
Crypt where we get like a central narrator beyond what is implied by again being told it's Kurosawa's dreams and the intertitles. But so the first vignette is an interesting
Yeah.
one. Only because I think it kind of it's that weird abstractness where it's like it's not entirely clear if the rest of the film is going to be this way or how long it's going to play out for because it's oddly structured. It's called Sunshine Through the Rain, and it feels very much like a fable,
Yeah.
in which a young boy is told by his mother to stay home on a rainy day because apparently the local legend is that the foxes get married on those days when the sun shines through it. And apparently it's bad luck to witness it. Sure enough, he goes out into the forest, witnesses a procession of not foxes, well, people wearing fox attire, having this big ornate celebration in the woods. He is then spotted by the foxes and goes home. There are many ways that this can go, David,
Yep.
and instead, the mom gives him a knife and says that a fox came by. They're looking for you. You have to go find them and beg forgiveness, and you can't come home until you do. And then the boy takes the knife and he goes off to look for the foxes, and that's the first
Well,
vignette.
and it
We never come back to this, Dave,
no.
and it seems like it sets itself up almost like what you would think. It's almost like a Western viewer's idea of what a magical Japanese story would be like, and then cuts itself off completely with no closure or resolution.
But at the same time, I mean, and I'm not gonna lie, I really like this vignette for precisely these reasons. Because number one,
Yeah, and I think that shift, though, that play of expectations, I think that's hilarious.
well, exactly, because I mean, again, it's a very peculiar thing. So first of all, it ends on an image that I think is not only striking, I mean, it became the poster for this film in a roundabout way, which is the small boy walking towards the rainbow, knife in hand, making his way, and that's when it cuts to black after that, and that's the end of it. So yeah, we have no idea whether he finds a way to appease or not. And again, it's interesting in the sense that A, we're denied that closure, but it sets up a couple interesting things where it's this idea of, if these are indeed dreams, we'll put it this way, and we're reading this into Kurosawa's mindset. Effectively, what we're sort of looking at here is this idea of death on the mind in many ways. And again, I think it's, and again, putting aside that, again, I probably have zero cultural context for recognizing whether there's any actual fables surrounding foxes and fox weddings that are actually rooted in Japanese folklore that I can
But
speak
I mean,
to.
to your point as well, though, it's a film that's also designed to invite sort of not only what does this vignette mean or what does this dream mean, and then the second sort of armchair speculation of what does it mean to Kurosawa. Kurosawa.
Yeah,
and I mean, like, it's a film that actively invites you to do that, and not to sound like I'm down on it or anything, but I think it's fair to say that, like, that's primarily what the film is interested in. And I mean, as a result, I don't think, on a functional level, any of the vignettes really ever ask the audience to do anything different.
Well, no. And I mean, certainly it's enhanced by the way in which the films are credited, because the sort of one recurring sort of protagonist of this film, the character of I, is just named that. I, as in the personal pronoun in this instance. So, again, when you're thinking about that in terms of, well, who is the I, then who is the speaker of saying, I had a dream? Well, who else is there when we're taking a look at who's written and directed this movie and who's clearly making I out to be as much like them, it seems, as possible? Yeah, yeah. You're kind of led to the path.
Because, I mean, normally we say that we don't read a lot of author intent into a work, but this is also a film that in many ways is very upfront about that. Yeah, we're actually supposed to.
Well, precisely. So we have this vignette that closes on this ambiguous note that sort of sets up this combination of, it's probably a bit much to say dream logic, despite the title, but it's certainly, again, it's not afraid of abstraction, and it's certainly not afraid to push the boundaries of not quite magical realism.
It's not a kitchen sink realism here.
Well, no, exactly. And we close that, and that's enhanced by the time we go into the next vignette, which is the peach orchard in this instance, where in this instance, we see what...
Aesthetically, it's very similar. And again, we follow young people living in the woods in what appears to be a more historical Japan.
Yes, and we have in this instance here the small boy who... He's coming in, he's dropping off tea to his sister and her friends, and he's prepared all these cups and notices, well, there's an extra little friend of yours here, where is she? And they keep saying, it's like, no, there isn't, there wasn't the case. And out of the corner of his eye, in the way in which Kurosawa frames it so we can see her, there is this extra person here who he goes chasing around. And we're not really sure what's going on. Is this a ghost or what's happening? And what we ultimately find out is that the boy is sort of wanders out into what used to be the peach tree orchard that's been completely cut down by the boy's family in this instance here. And he's effectively visited by the spirits that represent the orchard, who basically chastise him for this, or it's like, this is all your fault. All that's gone. You're not going to ever see peach trees like this again.
They picked the wrong target. I don't think this kid chopped down all those peach trees by himself. I don't think he had a lot of say in the matter, but we see this, like, very elegantly staged, more traditional style of dance. And then they basically just turn to the kid and they're like, by the way, you killed us. How do you feel, you monster?
Well, effectively, my feeling...
But then, sort of, again, like, also because of that just odd array of symbols, it's like, where is this story even going? Instead, what happens is, though, the situation is defused because the boy breaks down in tears and basically admits, well, I didn't want my family to cut them down. I love peach trees, just like you.
Yeah, and the spirits basically turn around, look at each other, and it's like, all right, well, just this last time, we're going to let you see the peach tree blossoms, which leads to another sort of processional dance type thing with the boy seeing. And again, in very vivid imagery, we see this beautiful sort of cascade of the peach tree buds and leaves falling to the ground and over on this thing before eventually the boy is sort of distracted and the image is gone, everybody's disappeared. And that's effectively the end of the short. And I'm not going
to
lie. Yeah.
And I think here, David, I think I would like to just point out that we're only through the first two vignettes, but this is probably about 20 or 30 minutes of screen time. And I think that also just speaks to the kind of film that this is, where it's not so much about the plot or the narrative logic, but it's about watching Kurosawa be a filmmaker as well.
Yeah.
And it is that attention to detail and sort of that that very disciplined composition, that it's the experience of that I think is really what carries these vignettes along, because it's not in a hurry to get anywhere, but it's also not a film that's necessarily interested in causal narrativity the way that many are.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, you can describe most of the vignettes very simply, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily play out quickly.
Well, no, they do not play out quickly. And again, we have, and you're quite right. I mean, there's some absolutely beautiful tableau shots in this sequence here. Again, particularly once we see the spirits, and they're sort of all organized along this spherical, or not spherical, vertical plane, effectively, there, and spread out across the screen. I mean, it's gorgeously constructed, but at the same time, I'm willing to admit this is probably one of my least favorite vignettes of the film, mostly because it's, and again, this is going to sound kind of mean-spirited, and again, I'll admit, cultural context, I may be missing this, but it's a story about a kid who's sad that his peach tree orchard got cut down. There is
Somebody had to say it, Dave.
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a gorgeous vignette. It may be the most visually impressive one, especially because it's the natural forestry of the shooting location, as well as all of the constructed costumes and that. Just in terms of what happens is pretty facile.
Well, it is. And I mean, again, it keeps the themes of the idea of death and the f rebirth sort of coming up. Because again, it's the idea that not just have the orchard's been destroyed, but again, that chance for sort of seasonal renewal is gone. So again, it's returning to that idea of death in a different way, in this instance, which it certainly comes
I
back in a
mean,
very.
I guess that carries us through to part three.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of taking forever while
Oh,
looking good,
God, yeah.
we get the blizzard.
Yeah, and this one apparently, from what I understand, I guess Kurosawa was a bit of a mountaineer, and one of the men in this procession, though I would be damned if I could tell you which one, is supposedly another representation of I in this instance. I don't know if it's our actual lead in this story or not. Because it doesn't seem like it's the same type of individual here. But effectively, what we have is a series of four men lost in a blizzard up in the mountains. This, for the most part, like basically it feels like about 10 minutes of watching them wander in slow motion, gradually.
Because it is about 10 minutes,
Well, it
Dave.
is, and ultimately them deciding it's like, we can't really find our way, maybe we're going to die here, maybe we should rest for a second. And then they all sort of pass out, and we effectively see a representation of the snow and cold visit them as a sort of female entity of death waiting to embrace them. And
And this one gave me strong echoes of the film Quite On,
yeah.
which has a scene that aesthetically and thematically is very similar to this one.
Yeah, and again, I will say, visually, this is an absolutely gorgeous sequence in terms of the filmmaking. The staging of it is magnificent, and I can 99% sure this was shot on a sound stage, and doesn't matter. Like, Kurosawa recreates the idea of being stuck in a blizzard absolutely magnificently in this sequence here. And yeah, there is some absolutely gorgeous imagery once the sort of snow demon spirit of death arrives. But again, it takes for freaking ever to go anywhere
Yeah.
in this instance.
Well, because all of it is in the service of just eventually he resists the maiden, he summons his courage and the other men's courage, and then they find their camp.
Well,
And then the vignette ends.
yeah.
So, I mean, again, it's like we ran into with Vendors last time, where it's sort of what's. Like, we're fine with meditative films or slow burns, but what's it ultimately in the service of? And I mean, I'm not going to tell Kurosawa his business. Obviously, he's better at it than I am. But this is maybe the one that felt the most padded artificially. And maybe it's just owing to however faithfully recreated, we're still just watching a lot of close-ups of a guy in a blizzard.
Well, you're not wrong. And I mean, again, if there was more thematic going on at this point, but the thing is there isn't really anything. This is really just setting up sort of, again, you could argue that this is that it drags on and on and on to help create that sense of desperation and loss, but that might be the intent. What the actual effect on the audience might be is this going to get moving anytime soon? And that's
Yeah. I'm like, I paid $12. I don't want to know what it feels like to die of frostbite. I want to be entertained.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, again,
Yeah.
beautiful.
But I mean, thematically, though, that hooks to the next segment, the tunnel, which Ironically enough, may end up being one of my favorites. The same way that the first vignette and second vignette seem to be related to one another, and then we break to the third and fourth, but they seem to be related to one another.
Well, absolutely. And I'm going to go straight ahead and say, yeah, the tunnel is my straight up favorite for this one. It's also the one, though, that, again, I find you're right in the sense that it is connected to the third one, and it is very much about the issue of death, as we'll get into, but it's also the one that I puzzle over in terms of its connections with Kurosawa's life, because from everything I get sense, our main character in this sequence is the, I believe they identify his rank as the lieutenant, but at any rate, he's an, yeah, an
He
officer.
was the commander of a unit,
Yeah.
and we get what feels like a very painterly scene. He's walking down the road at night, and he's coming home from war, and then he comes across the tunnel. And then first the dog
Yeah.
runs out of it. And you don't often see a dog with explosives.
Yeah.
But then as he walks in, we end up getting like a very simple look, but a very effective one. And I love the color balancing
Yeah.
here, where he ends up meeting Noguchi, who is one of his men, who's wearing his soldier's fatigues, and he has dark makeup paint around his eyes, and the rest is like a deep blue.
Yeah.
And we very quickly realize that he is as he looks. He's dead, as we learn through conversation. But Noguchi doesn't seem to believe it. And as he walks through the tunnel, though, he ends up coming across more soldiers, and eventually he comes across the entire platoon of his dead soldiers.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, in many ways, this feels like a really great Twilight Zone short, where basically it is this commanding officer confronting his feelings of survivor's guilt, of guilt over his men dying, and trying to sort of grapple with that there. And it's all basically staged at the mouth of this tunnel at the after he's exited it. And yeah, we don't really move from the sequence. Like, literally, I can imagine they shot this thing in maybe like 2 or 3 days, at most, to get all the shots in.
Well, yeah, it's a simple plot and it plays out simply, but it's also, this is one of the few vignettes that I think are most interesting to look at, or maybe is a bit more complex than it appears, only because like we also see sort of the commander himself like trying to take different approaches in response to that grief,
Yeah.
because like at first he tries to tell Noguchi like, no, you're dead. This is my rational explanation. And then he starts denying it. And then he starts addressing his men by then being very emotional. And he gives like that very impassioned speech where he says, I can't make up for the fact that you guys died for no reason. There is never any reason for any of us to go to war in the first place. And now you're dead and we can't do anything about it. And that doesn't move the men either. And it's only when he finally like goes back into his role as lieutenant and orders them to about face and march down the tunnel do they finally listen.
Yeah, and then,
And
yeah.
it's interesting only because it doesn't seem to have a clear allegorical reading in and of itself. And then it's even more complicated by it ends with him walking outside, and then the dog comes back and starts barking at him, and then we cut to black.
Well, absolutely. And I think taken on its own, if you divorce this one from the entire film, I think anybody could watch this one and really pick up on the general themes and ideas of what's going on in it. Where I get a little more lost is the sort of biographical aspect of it, because again, I'm not.
Like this one may on surface like have the least to do with Kurosawa's
Well, and
biography.
that's the thing, because from my understanding is number one, I don't believe he may have served in the army, but I don't believe he ever saw active combat. In fact, from my understanding is he was mostly making films while the war was going on. So it's not a case of, I think, I don't know, I'm not even sure he was an active soldier. So you can't necessarily read him as the commander in this case. And I don't think the commander is necessarily credited as I either, in this instance. So it's a question of, well, this one's, I mean, it's another dream where you can read the whole piece of, well, what does this mean in terms of Kurosawa's psychology and where his mind's at this point? But in terms as a piece of is he deliberately reflecting his own biography in it? I'm kind of at a loss to explain that here. But somebody more...
I think the next one, though, is probably... probably also one of the most linear to read, though, and certainly the most easy to sort of put within his Kurosawa's biography, though, and that's Crows, which is basically the vignette where this is why George Lucas came on board with the project. It's weird to think of Kurosawa as like a big effects piece, but that's kind of what we're getting here.
Yeah.
Because this one, we clearly have the character of I sitting in an art gallery looking at Van Gogh paintings.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he just happens to go inside of them. And, you know, much of what plays out, though, is just, you know, the technology on display of the characters walking around in depth in a landscape that is very much Van Gogh's art style. And this comes to a head with him coming to a figure who's sketching furiously in a field, played by Martin Scorsese. We then see a conversation between I and Vincent Van Gogh.
Yeah, and this one is... like, this is the one where you can probably take the most potential number of readings in terms of the layers that are going on here. Because on one hand, in terms of the sort of themes of death, Van Gogh was very, I mean, notoriously, he committed suicide eventually, and his mental health has been of much speculation given to many of the actions that went on in his lifetime. So, I mean, and certainly as this film points out, I mean, he's the individual who cut a portion of his own ear off because he couldn't quite get it right in his self-portraits there. That was his...
which Scorsese makes sure to throw in there. It's also weird how he kept yelling at I to leave the meter running while he kept looking up the... Oh, different Scorsese acting appearance.
But that's... it's more...
Yeah, like, he does... Yeah. He does fine there. He's an erratic Italian guy playing another erratic Italian guy. But yeah, this is very much, though, like, I think symbolically, Kurosawa's sort of ode to one of his biggest influences.
Well,
I mean, it's well done. It's, again, I think this is one of the ones that is very simple to read. And saying that makes it sound like it's negative, but I mean, it's gorgeously composed. There's just not a lot to this one.
Well, I think the most you can get out of it is, aside from the fact that he's paying ode to Van Gogh and the fact that ultimately this ends with effectively I just sort of wandering, chasing down Van Gogh himself, trying desperately to find him through painting to painting, and that's basically where it ends. I mean, the fact that...
Well, he finds him in with the crows, and then he snaps back to being in the museum, and then he leaves.
Well, yes, but I think the big thing here is, I think the casting of Scorsese is kind of the big centerpiece of this, because, again, there's no reason Kurosawa couldn't have cast, you know, probably a more notable actor in that role. Because, again, Scorsese's done some acting.
And this scene itself is anomalous because the rest of the film is in Japanese. This sequence is in both English and French.
Yeah.
But Scorsese's dialogue is completely in English, no subtitles. So it almost feels like this one is positioned to be a standalone segment for a Western audience in ways that the other ones aren't.
Well, either positioned to be a standalone film for a Western audience, but it's also a case where I'm wondering if there is a metatextual reading about... Again, because let's not forget, Scorsese by this point has very much cemented his reputation in America cinema by this point. Like, this is, you know, Goodfellas is coming up the same year as this one, so I don't even think that would have been on his mind, but he's already had, you know, Taxi Driver, Mean Streets, Raging Bull, The King of New York, and you know, how many other great films under his belt. So part of me almost wonders if I hesitate to say passing of the torch or anything to that effect, but almost like a recognition of the next generation of sort of international filmmakers. And the thing with Scorsese is,
And I mean, that's something very much kind of in keeping with the, not to say that it's absolutely there, but the presumed theme of Lucas and Spielberg being involved as well. That this is sort of old and new working together to to give that gold watch party in a sense.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly, yeah. I mean, it's all very telling that these are all the film brat filmmakers of the 70s who are involved in this project. Mercifully, Brian De Palma was kept very, very far away. I'm sure this would have gone in a very different direction with his involvement. But yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, but speaking of a very different direction, though...
Oh, yeah. Arguably my second favorite one in the...
Really? Oh, man.
Because
this... We okay. Yeah. I'm just saying that we go from like this very neat standalone, almost sort of like playful sequence, to suddenly kind of do Mount Fuji in Red, which opens on Mount Fuji, basically exploding as a number of different nuclear reactors break down, and a panicked crowd is absolutely stampeding.
See, and the reason I like this one is it basically almost becomes like a dark comedy as it goes on, with effectively
I don't think it's meant to be comedic, Dave.
It maybe it isn't, but as I'm looking at, and that's the thing, it reads as comedic to me, and maybe this is a purely misunderstood my part, but it feels like partly this is Kurosawa. I believe the sentiment behind it, the anti-nuclear sentiment and fear of nuclear energy, is very much there. And this idea of sort of an apocalyptic event, this idea of death, not just for himself, but for a larger society, I believe he's absolutely sincere about it. But it also feels like, in terms of the staging, it's very much playing to sort of a throwback style of disaster filmmaking from Japan in a certain way, which may or may not be caused because of some of the rumors surrounding this sequence, which we'll get to in a minute. But then it basically boils down to this mother with her son, and then what will ultimately turn out to be, presumably one of the scientists who worked at these nuclear power plants, just sort of having this conversation about why did we dye the gas so that we could see it? Like, what was going on? And that's the sort of thing where it's like, yes, we dyed radiation so we could see it, folks. That's why I have to wonder whether this was intended to be comedic, because the reason obviously he does it is in order to make, you know, this poisoning visual on screen. There's no question about that. But also the fact that they're treating it with like all the solemnity of like a 1950s B movie feels like a deliberate
and I don't
choice.
Know how we're supposed to read it, because we got the woman screaming with her two kids, we've got and we've got the doctor.
Yeah.
Very much framed as the doctor. See the red? That's plutonium.
Yeah.
It'll give you cancer. It's, you know, it just totally, it is so different to the scene that came before. It also is very confusing how we're actually supposed to take this. Which is, again, compounded when the Doctor then jumps off a cliff, and as the clouds encroach on the woman and her children, he takes off his jacket and then starts ineffectually swatting at the clouds. And again, it's a bizarre image, and I'm not sure if it's intended to be funny or not, because the rest of it does seem pretty serious, where, like, because the theme of everything the Doctor is saying is, like, look, we have the ability to do so many things, invent so much wonderful stuff, and we came up with nuclear power, and that poisoned the world, and then our next great idea on top of it is, well, we'll color code it so we know what's actually going to kill us. Why couldn't we have been growing tomatoes?
See, and the thing about it is like, it's entirely possible that this was Akira Kurosawa trying to do just a legitimate science fiction piece, and just fell into the trap of writing like the super didactic, you know, 1950s throwback. Like, the preceding 30 years of science fiction filmmaking hadn't happened in the process. But at the same time, like...
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, though, because this sequence also had some direction from Ishiro Honda.
Supposedly, and this is the big thing. From what I understand, there are claims surrounding it that, yeah, Ishiro Honda, who was a good friend of Akira Kurosawa, and who had basically come out of retirement around the time, I think he was, maybe even before Ron, to sort of act as sort of a consultant and, you know, sort of be a helper for Kurosawa on these films. Supposedly, he was given Kurosawa's storyboards, and he directed the sequence. I do not know whether that is true or not. The thing is I can't see a confirmation one way or the other as to why that would be the case.
I mean, it would explain why this one definitely seems more didactic, much more sci-fi, and certainly much more shall we say, overt than the other vignettes in its overall aesthetic.
See, and it's the thing where the aesthetic would probably be the main thing you could pin on it, because presumably this is still Akira Kurosawa's script, because at no indication do I see did anybody else work on the screenplay aside from him. So, I mean, even if it is somebody else directing the sequence for him, and again, for those who aren't aware, Honda, he was a director most famously for Gojira, the original version of Godzilla. He also directed a number of the more playful sequels to that film as well. And certainly, I mean, I would say maybe the relationship in terms of between him and Kurosawa is, if Kurosawa is maybe the sort of the artist there, he's the, maybe somewhere but like a Scorsese style figure himself. And this one's for you, Ross. Ashiro Honda is more the Ivan Reitman, where it's like, yeah, he makes big films, but I mean, he seems very comfortable being sort of the company guy. More often than that, it's like, oh, you want to make a film with Godzilla dancing? Sure. We'll do that. And it seems to
I mean, most guys wish they could make Godzilla dance.
be, yeah, but that's the thing where I admit one way or the other, I will flat out admit this one is the odd one out in terms of this film, but it is also, I think, because it's such a radical departure and because it moves at such a brisk clip comparatively, I find it also one of the most engaging and enjoyable
Yeah,
of the
there's
entire
nothing
film.
dull about this sequence. I will certainly give you that one. It's like, I don't know, it's sort of like in Gone with the Wind, how it's a long movie and there are long stretches where nothing happens, and then there are other points where, like, in the span of 10 minutes, Atlanta burns down and four main characters have kids and die. Yeah, this is, I don't know, it really does stand out on its own. But that being said, the next sequence, the Weeping Demon, almost seems to be much more directly related to this scene because we see Ai wandering around the aftermath of the ruined world following a nuclear holocaust. And if not for the clip there, you would almost think, without the title offsetting it, that this is just the same sequence extended.
Yeah, and it's not clear whether, yeah, it's meant to be or not, and it's kind of irrelevant whether it is or isn't necessarily in this case, because ultimately, yeah, it's just basically this encounter with, as the title says, a weeping demon. Except the demon isn't necessarily a demon in that sort of sense of the supernatural. It's a mutation. It's somebody who was human who's been transformed by the radioactivity that's across the land, and we basically get to see.
Yeah, it's like a slower, more meditative version of the Violence Jack OVA. Shout out to the real ones. No, but like, again, you can certainly see how people like George Miller direct post-apocalyptic sequences. We get a very Kurosawan post-apocalypse.
Exactly. And there is some staggeringly beautiful imagery throughout the sequence, particularly when you sort of get into, I guess, like the pits, I guess is the best way to put it, and you start seeing what's going there. I would also like to say, and again, this one's for you also, Ross, the giant dandelions feels like somebody over Michael Pressman may have seen this movie and said, you know what Ninja Turtles 2 needs? Giant dandelions. That's what the ooze is doing
Oh,
at the
see, I
opening.
was thinking Kurosawa about to retire, and then he sees Day of the Triffids, and he's like, nope, back in the saddle.
That could also, there's nothing saying that these things can't also be the case. But yes, I mean,
Yeah,
certainly.
for all we know, it's everyone else who's wrong.
Exactly. But yeah, in this instance, we certainly see the story play. And again, it plays out ultimately in death as well, and sort of suggesting the gradual slow descent in death, because there's this concern of basically, even in the nuclear holocaust, people are going to get picked off there, because it's sort of the food chain continuing. It's like, well, if I don't eat you, somebody's ultimately eventually going to eat me in the process. And
Yeah.
that sort of idea
And the
recur.
hierarchy is by the number of horns that you have, but it also sort of has that that sort of Divine Comedy style tiered form of hell where the ones with two horns eat the one horns and that and so on. But also most of the privileged horns were privileged people in real life too.
Exactly. So it's not exactly subtle in its social commentary that's going on here. Much like the preceding sequence wasn't subtle in its social commentary. So on this point, yeah, you get the, I mean, these are probably the sequences that come closest to Kurosawa being the old man telling the kids to get off his lawn, metaphorically speaking, in this instance.
Well, not even that as much as this is Kurosawa This is Kurosawa saying, and that's why you always leave a note,
Yeah.
right? This is him showing us a ruined world and saying, see, and that's why you don't use nuclear power.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's again, there's not a lot to this sequence. I again, but it moves at a brisk clip. It is very, again, there is some wonderful, gorgeous imagery throughout. Some of the makeup effects are great. And compared to, like, we didn't really talk about the Fox makeup in the first sequence or first vignette there itself too much, because it's deliberately designed not to be realistic in that case. It clearly is a dance troupe, basically in Fox masks and face paint, as they sort of very use their body language to get that eerie effect. This is much more, yeah, no, we're putting in actual makeup effects to sort of suggest that there has been legitimate mutation here, and it's effective in a different way compared to that.
It ends very abruptly, all the same, though.
Yeah.
Right? Because you think it's going to be going somewhere. You think you're going to learn something. And then basically, the demon just turns to Ai and says, get out of here. You want to become a demon too? And then he runs off into the fog, and that's about that.
Yeah, so I mean, and again, I guess that's one of those things where it almost feels like the logic of dreams in the sense of the disruption, the interruption, where you always just sort of, there's no like neat conclusion to dreams. They just end in some way. So, I mean, there is an effectiveness to that as a concept. But this then leads us into the final segment of the film, which is the Village of Watermills, which is a complete 180 shift from the last two, to say the least.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I think if the film sort of has a thesis vignette, it's this one.
Well, exactly. And it really just involves I as he sort of comes across a 100-plus-year-old man played by Chizuru Yu, yes, our returning guest from last week, there, and they sort of discuss the nature. I mean, there's a funeral procession going on in the background. This is somebody that the old man was talking about. And again, it's basically just this very meditative discussion of life and death itself, and what it sort of means.
Yeah,
Yeah.
the village is they're a bunch of real and prims. No, they just have a very simple traditional way of living. They say that they forsake things like power and telephones and that. They just live simply off the land, make their water mills and such, and that's fine. And it's almost like one of the Platonic dialogues where it's just I asking various questions. And Socratic dialogues, that's the one, the thing it's named after. But he keeps asking, like, well, what do you do for this? And the old man just has an answer. And then he starts going off that, no, it's better to live simply. And the person who died today, they died at a ripe old age of 80. And yeah, it's a good life when you're born and you work hard and then you die and you're happy. That's how it is. Life goes on. We're at peace with it.
And then he joins the funeral procession himself to somebody who, by his own admission, broke his hearts years ago, but he basically takes up the lead in a sort of cheerful as he's leading this procession as it goes away. And we see.
Yeah, but the other important part, though, is that the traveler asks about this mound of
Yes.
flowers, and the old man tells him the local legend that long ago a traveler was coming through. Stayed in the village, he died, and they put up the marker. And just from that day on, people started leaving flowers there as they walked past. And nobody understands why they started doing it, but that's what is done, and that's why they keep doing it. And sure enough, by the end of the vignette, as I walks past, he too lays a flower. And it's like, do we need to spell out sort of what Corso is trying to say here?
Not really. I think this is the thing about, like, the film is not subtle about its intents here by any stretch of the imagination. It sometimes is questionable about how all these things connect together, in terms of the vignettes themselves. But I mean, it's a very, straightforward and honestly, given the note it ends on, very optimistic film about addressing one's own mortality in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, it comes off as a very tranquil scene. And it is an excellent sequence overall. It feels warm. It sends us off on a very good note.
Well, absolutely. And mercifully, we don't see Sam Farber and Claire make their way through it with their goggles and film. Although that would have been an interesting thing to have seen happen as well.
Well, just because you can doesn't mean that you ought to. But yeah, and that's more or less the film. In talking about structure as we're going through it, it sort of dawned on me that, I mean, we can sit here and talk about that. Actually, this film works best when you think about how, even though there's eight vignettes, it's actually four thematic pairs or things like that. And I'm like, I don't know if that necessarily adds value into this film, simply because so much of it, like dreams themselves, is experiencing that subjectivity.
Well, you're not wrong, and that's the thing where it's hard to. You can intellectualize this movie, but it seems, yeah, to defeat the point of doing so, because it is experiential in some ways, and as didactic as Kurosawa gets in this movie. And let's be clear, you're not going to walk away without knowing his thoughts on nuclear power and what we should all be doing about that. He's not. It really is a case where it's still about come in and experience what I have for you here in this instance. Come see my, last great work of art in here. And I will say, is this my favorite Kurosawa movie? Is this the one that I get the most out of? No, but I also really kind of appreciate it at the same time. Like, this feels.
And I don't think most people would put this necessarily as their favorite Kurosawa film or the best one. But I mean, I think given that this film really is kind of Kurosawa's personal capstone on his career, or even though this didn't end up being his final film, it very much feels like him being done with movies and him being done with life. Like, I don't think that saying this film doesn't reach the heights of Hidden Fortress or Throne of Blood, I don't think that's necessarily the point of a film like this. Like, we've mocked the idea of being critic-proof before, but this is a case where I feel like it strangely fits. Like, you have to appreciate this film, if and only if by virtue of the fact that Kurosawa did solid work for the better part of 50 years, and this is him sort of like saying goodbye on his own terms. So I don't think there's anyone who's going to be like, oh, this is the worst film I've ever seen.
Well, absolutely. I mean, certainly he didn't have the Jean-Luc Godard antagonism towards both his industry and art form and the audience there that basically sabotaged his career for the latter part of 40 years in many ways. But I would say in the case of Kurosawa, you're absolutely right. And I think the other thing about it is that this is very much, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, this is an old man's movie. Anyways, this is not the film of a young man, whereas things like, Hidden Fortress or Seven Samurai or Rashomon, that's the work of somebody who's in the, young enough and, really passionate enough and really seeking out to make these sort of big imprints in some ways, whether intentionally or not, but like they feel like very driven, I gotta get these out works. Whereas this is. Now I'm old. We can take our time. We can, sort of rest, breathe in, breathe out. And honestly, I would think that probably the ideal audience for this film is probably as people who are in maybe their 70s and 80s, except for the fact that they might fall asleep during the blizzard sequence because of how long it freaking goes on in the process there.
Well, I think it's more a film made for people who know Kurosawa, and like not that this is fan service or anything,
No.
but I think he's also making this for the kind of people that really sort of perpetuated his successes, especially in the West. Like, in a lot of ways, this feels like maybe his most internationally oriented film in terms of that overall universality. Certainly has a bit more of an international production history, and more international names attached to it. But like, honestly, I would say if you haven't seen a Kurosawa film before, or you don't know anything about Kurosawa, don't watch this movie
No.
because a lot of it isn't going to make sense or seem worthy, but also because it's stylistically anomalous from a lot of what Kurosawa does in his other work, at the level of structure, but like also it's just across the vignettes themselves, they're disparate enough that no clear sense of Kurosawa's style can be seen here in the ways that sort of watching his full-length films, or certainly his more epic films, really give rise to. And I think that's just because, like we saw with Until the End of the World, when you have such a loose organizational structure, like your film can be many styles, but ultimately, what style do we get overall? And in both cases, it sort of becomes jumbled to the point where the answer is, I don't really know.
Well, you're not entirely wrong. I think there's enough of that sort of thematic material to sort of tightly connect it together that I think it keeps it from being shapeless overall at the end of the day. And it certainly has, I think, a greater degree.
Yeah, and there's definitely a point to the film. It's just maybe that because of what how the sequences can be so different in terms of like time, location, and mise-en-scène, and how that all filters through, you don't necessarily get the best sense of Kurosawa as an aesthetician as you would from, say, Seven Samurai.
Well, absolutely. And I would say, and that's certainly a fair criticism of the film. And again, I also say this with the caveat that, once again, as usual, we're not experts on Japanese cinema. There could be a whole layer of very culturally specific elements going on. And I would honestly say that this is probably, we started off the conversation talking about the universality of Kurosawa. This is the one where I would say probably among the films that this is more very specific towards a Japanese audience in certain ways. Because I even though for all the international influence, for all of that's going on, this feels very much like Kurosawa talking to Japan, more directly than he's talking to a worldwide audience necessarily. Given the things, not just because of the youthful sequences, but particularly by the latter parts of it, and when it becomes about the future of Japan, about Japan's nuclear policies, effectively, in that, like, he very much feels to be addressing something that doesn't exist in the same way with the United States or Canada or Russia or other nations on Earth, and quite
Yeah, I
the
mean, I get what you're saying. And again, it's sort of the pressure of who the intended audience is. I think that's another thing that just sort of emerges by the fact that it is that vignette structure. Because I mean, like the crow scene feels very much for Western audiences, but you're right, the last couple really do feel a bit more like, hey, friends and neighbors, what are we doing as a Japanese society?
Exactly. So, I mean, I guess with having arrived at the conclusion that this is effectively the Jay and Silent Bob reboot of Kurosawa movies, it's made just for the fans, not for the critics or the wider
Yeah.
audiences.
No, Chris Hemsworth, this movie sucks.
You're going to see this as a Fathom event, one night only, playing across Canada and North America, folks, before Kurosawa road shows the sucker. Just.
That'll be very impressive considering he died in 1998. But that being said, yeah, I mean, like, this is the kind of film that, again, I don't necessarily know if there's any overall singular message I can get from it, beyond the fact that these are sort of thoughts and feelings and musings and dreams of Kurosawa's, and it does give us some insight into a very talented artist and a very influential one. So, this is not a film without value. I think definitely the more you appreciate film history and film studies, and certainly Japanese cinema, you'll probably get a little bit more out of it, but yeah, perfectly inoffensive and nice to look at. Much like my friend Dave, who's going to introduce our patent-pending bumper segment of Hits and
I
Picks.
can't tell whether that was a backhanded compliment or not here, folks. Putting that
It was a segue, and that's all I needed it to be.
fair enough. Pits and pits. So I guess in terms of trying to give us a sort of first hit here, I'm actually going to give it to the cinematographers on this film. Yes, that's plural. Taku Saito and Soji Ueda. Again, my pronunciation's likely wrong. Do not go with me. But again, they had worked with particularly Saito had worked with Kurosawa a few times. Most notably, both worked with him on his preceding film, Ron, as well. These were sort of late stage collaborators, as from what I can tell of their credits. They were not people who'd been working with him for decades by this point. That said, this is still an incredibly good-looking movie overall. Whatever other issues we may have with it in terms of pacing and tone, you can't. There are entire frames of this film where if you stopped and paused it at any given moment, again, much like a painting, you're going to get your money's worth in this instance from what you're seeing up on stage. And again, whether it's the tableaus in the peach orchard, or again, that beautiful rainbow shot from early in the film, or yes, my beloved weird color dyed radiation tinting the screen as it goes across. There is some striking visuals throughout this film, and highly worth watching this in the best format you can at any given time. What about you, Andrew? What would be your first hit for this film?
I think I'm going to break the mold. I mean, it is 2021 after all, and I am going to, I think for the first time ever, give my first hit to a segment.
Okay.
That would be to the tunnel sequence. I think that is sort of, that's sort of all the different registers of the film that is trying to do at various points. I think that's sort of when they all synchronize the best. And even though it's comes off as a much more constructed set, it is probably the most visually interesting, which is odd because it is one of the more minimal ones. That being said, and I know it's kind of funny because that's the one that sort of seems most open in terms of how we're supposed to read it. And yeah, that was the one I was most interested in. So for a film that kind of has an episodic anthology type structure, that is the strongest one. So I would say watch that one. If you like it, you'll probably dig the rest of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about that. I'm also going to give, in this instance, a hit here to, and again, please forgive my pronunciation, Takeo Saito, Shinichiro Ikebe, who composed the music for this film here. Now, he'd done Kagamusha, Kurosawa's earlier film.
Kagamusha.
Yeah, there. And also would go on to do films such as Murder on D Street, which I haven't seen. Conan the Future Boy, which I haven't seen and assume is not related to John Milius's movie. And The Big Giant Robot Resurrection, which I have also not seen.
Isn't it Future Boy Conan? Isn't that a manga series?
It may very well be, in this instance.
Wait, there's also Detective Conan.
So.
Oh, man.
There's a lot of Conans out there.
Anime. One day we'll get an excuse to get to anime. And that'll be a glorious day indeed.
Turn in.
Won't it, Dave?
Yeah, turn in 2 weeks, folks. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's not a score full of memorable, like, this is not something you're going to come out humming at the end of the day, but it's all about setting mood and the tone of the piece, and it does its job effectively well. And again, as much as the blizzard sequence doesn't work overall, you can't fault the music for trying to tie it all together as we see people walking for 10 minutes in the middle of a snowstorm and trying to make it effective for everybody to overall in terms of there being that sense of dread to it. So it does indeed get my hit for this one. Again, not spectacular work, but I think darn fine work in this instance. What about you, Andrew? What would be your final hit for Akira Kurosawa's Dreams?
I mean, somebody has to say it. Akira Kurosawa writing and directing. Like, maybe this is the Santana's Supernatural of his career, but I mean, he got to make the film he wanted to make, largely on the terms he wanted to make that. And that seems like a fitting reward to someone who, by many accounts, was also just a very sensitive and kind person, as well as someone who showed a deep sensitivity in his work. You know, it's Hollywood is, in particular, and the film industry in general, is full of stories that do not have happy endings. And, I mean, there's something nice about the thought of somebody like Akira Kurosawa, in many ways, getting that ending, or at least the one that they wanted to have. And, I mean, we live in difficult and chaotic times, but the very existence of this film kind of proves to me that things do sort of work out in the end.
So you heard that right, folks. Somewhere, Akira Kurosawa was waiting to punch Zerder, noted scumbag. Oh, God, I'm blanking on his name. Why? Oh, Jeffrey Jones.
Where are you even going?
There we go.
Oh.
Yeah. I was going to say, noted scumbag, Kira Kurosawa's just going to give him a nice punt kick down into hell and, all will be well.
David, I think you've officially lost me on this one, but that's okay. Because speaking of being officially lost, it's time to turn to the pit segment, where I mean, I'm gonna go out and say it. I would probably say that the Godzilla sequence lost me, only because it seems like it was airlifted out of a completely different film.
I will. On one hand, I can't.
And by the Godzilla sequence, I mean Mount Fuji in Red.
Yeah, and see, I won't disagree that it's a very big shift that suddenly happens. It's also a shift I wasn't opposed to happening at that point, so I'm a little more forgiving. I would say if we're going for,
Yeah, it's fine.
I would say for more specific sequences, the peach trees, it's just, I mean, or the peach orchard. Again, it's beautifully constructed, but it is such a non-essential sequence in this movie and the most easily
Yeah.
overlooked in terms of its impact.
And I think that ties in nicely to my general pit, which is the same reason I don't like solos in music after a point, where it's like, yes, you are an excellent filmmaker. You are a great director. You have such an attention to detail. And yes, I am watching you be an absolute master at your work, and I'm still watching you do that. And now I'm watching you do it and wondering when something's going to happen in this vignette. It's not to say that this is a film that is a vanity piece or anything, but I mean, hand in hand with the idea of watching the master craftsman do his thing, sometimes there's more watching.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's just, if this is a case where it sort of brings me to my second pit in this instance, which is editor Tomei Minami. Again, pronunciations don't quote me, who I don't think you can blame it necessarily on him in this instance for a couple reasons. One here, this is Kurosawa's movie. Anything that the editor's doing is probably doing at the behest of Akira Kurosawa. It's not going to make it past him in terms of this film. So it's not like the editor came in and just did his own thing on this film, which is all the more telling because, again, in this case, the editor doesn't have a lot of other credits working specifically as an editor on other feature films. I almost wonder if he was selected specifically because his marching orders were just do what Akira Kurosawa tells you to do. More than anything else, because otherwise he mostly worked as a negative cutter on such of the following things, such as Super Mario Brothers, the Great Rescue Mission of Res to Rescue Princess Peach, and Mishima: A Life in Four Chapters. Yes, the Paul Schrader movie, in this instance. So, again, Mario, Schrader, it all goes together in some way, shape, or form. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to knock him too much, but the editing on this film, it could have been tighter, and honestly, a couple of these sequences probably could have been dropped straight up, and made an even more coherent movie at the end of the day, at the very least.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of, well, I mean, I think I'm out, but just playing off of your point, it's you always have to ask yourself, especially with a master filmmaker, you have to assume that things are being done for a reason. And it's not always entirely clear what the reason for making this film a series of vignettes is, or rather, what is gained in doing so that couldn't be done in a conventional narrative film. But again, I'm not telling Kurosawa how to make a movie, and not just because he can't hear me right now.
Yeah, it was a Monday. He felt like doing it, and that's what happened. So, and really, honestly, that probably explains a good chunk of decisions that get made on a fi on films as well. But I mean, but.
But yeah, I think that's about it for me as far as dreams go.
Yeah.
Anything you want to get in before we figure out where we're going
No, I
next?
think I've been incoherent enough this episode.
Now you know how I feel. But yeah, so Dave, now that we're in interesting territory because we finally found our way over to Japan, I'm wondering, where are we going to go next? Are we going to follow Spielberg and look at the Twilight Zone movie? Are we going to follow George Lucas and do THX, whatever the numbers are?
1138.
I'm guessing no, though. So why don't you surprise us
Yeah,
all?
so we're not, no, we're not going to the Twilight Zone, the movie, as much as we really should cover that one of these days, and not just because we used, a piece of or screen grab from it as part of our art for the show.
Well, that and the fact that we're always banging on about the story.
Well, exactly, yeah, we gotta get into that in full one of these days. But no, instead we're actually
We already did in our Blues Brothers episode for some reason.
true. But instead, Blues Brothers 2000, let's be correct here.
Oh, yes, of course.
But no, instead we're actually going to follow three people who were working in smaller capacities on Dreams to different capacities on a different film made in that came out in 2016, because we're going to be following Tetsu Watanabe, an actor, Kazutoshi Watakura, who was a production assistant on Dreams, and Tsuyoshi Sugino, again, I'm probably botching the name, who was the second unit director on Dreams and a casting director on the film working here. And that is 2016's Shin Godzilla. Yes, from the creators of.
Shin Godzilla. This ain't your daddy's Godzilla.
Yes, and if you thought we were done with nuclear themes, oh boy, we're not done by a long shot. And not to mention, it gets us into. This is a film coming from the creator of Neon Genesis Evangelion. So,
Wait a sec. We're looking at Hideaki Anno. Oh my God.
yeah.
David said the E word. The next couple weeks are going to be very interesting.
Oh, you betcha. So, yeah, we're not leaving Japan quite yet. I said we were going to be here for about 4 weeks. This was just the kickoff of it, so we got a ways to go here yet, folks. But yeah, we're taking a look at arguably, I'll put my cards at the table, the second best Godzilla movie ever made, which is something to say.
Okay.
Yeah. But will you agree? Will you disagree? Well, the best way to find out will be to tune in next week, after you watch the movie, presumably, and then listen to what we have to say.
Yes,
But
and after David and I actually get some sleep sometime this week. In the meantime, though, we have our phones set to do not disturb, but as always, you can reach out to us while you wait for the next one to drop. David, where can people get in touch with you?
why, you can find me at 24 Panels. I'm a little bit busier right now, folks. I'm not gonna lie. It's been a very long several days, as we adapt to another more changing circumstances here in Ontario. But with that being said, I'm always happy to have a civil conversation. You don't have to worry. The Doctor Who New Year special came out. It's done. It's over with. I said my piece on it, which really wasn't much this time.
It's safe again to talk to Dave.
Exactly. So please tune in, come join us, converse. When I show up eventually. What about you, Andrew? Where can people find you online here to talk to?
You can find me on Twitter, usually not anymore, at Film Stripper, or you can email us directly at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, if you want to leave some more feedback, you can rate and review us in iTunes. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured chart, but most importantly, it's a place where you can leave some feedback because after almost, well, coming up on 150 episodes somehow, all Dave and I want to do every episode is bring you the kind of show that you want to listen to.
And seeing as how we've actually mapped out the next few weeks, I gotta actually count up what our 150th episode's actually gonna be about. Because odds are, again, we didn't plan out by the numbers and try and get ourselves somewhere specific, folks. It's just gonna land on whatever film we happen to have chosen at that time. And yeah.
We can just do all 26 episodes of Evangelion week by week.
Or
We'd probably get more listeners.
we could do that, but no, we're gonna stick with our tired and true formula of looking at obscure things and random weird things.
Tried, but nice Freudian slip there, too.
Yes. So, with that, yes, keep tuning in, folks. We've got a long stretch for you. And I will say for the record, though, our numbers have stabilized quite well over the past several weeks.
Hooray! Thank you, prior listeners who finally took advantage of the holiday to catch up on me and Dave getting more and more fatigued as the year has gone on.
Yeah. We're not going to say what day we recorded this on, but boy, we live in interesting times. But why we're.
They're all interesting ones.
Yeah.
But Dave, now's the part where you ask me if I have anything I'd like to say.
Indeed. Andrew, do you have any parting words for our listeners today?
Why, yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Or inspire you to make a series of vignettes into a feature film, which you will therefore release as sort of your master craftsman-like thing before actually dying after an extended period of time beyond that. But, you know, who's keeping track? Bye.
Look, there's cesium. It gives you birth defects.